When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
UBP, 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 which is another way of saying I'm Scott Tifford, you're Jules Gill, and that's Josh Brown.
UB3.
You might say a special episode recorded on a day after we've done a whole bunch of filming in fancy costumes and stuff, but you'll be seeing what that is in the future. Because we're in person, why not do a UB3 to mark the occasion?
Yes.
And we put a question tweet out, and people sent in all sorts of different things. So a massive thank you to people. I wanted to start the show off by saying a massive congratulations to Ambulam, who will be getting married tomorrow / very, very soon.
Amazing. I hope that we get thanked in the wedding speech. Also, where's our invite? And also, hope that some of your guests bought you a UBP mug to celebrate this.
Listen, you guys can speak for yourself. I'm best man. I got the invite the other week. So
you're best man in any room you walk into, mate.
Thank you. I would say this.
Yeah. Your man's default best man. Speaking of best things, we do have mugs on sale. However, I don't remember the big long URL. Someone made us one, though.
No, somebody made us a tiny URL, which was just something like ubpmugs.com. But
Don't go there.
Because it might be something completely different. so what it is that you go to Teespring on the What Culture merch thing, and in the wrestling section, for some reason, our mugs are there. I wish that I could remember the URL, but it is so
I think it's whatculture-wrestling. /creator-spring. I think that's what it is.
Yeah. That rolls off the tongue.
It does. That's what we always said.
I wanted to get on a t-shirt. It's just so catchy, but make a clothing brand out of it.
Can confirm that we have sold a nice little healthy amount of mugs, which is a massive thank you genuinely to everybody who's bought them. Absolutely love that that's happening. Anyway, did the huge shout out to Ambulam and just massive congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations.
Getting married's awesome. Recommend it. They also submitted a question saying, with the new Pokemon coming out next month, I find that I'm not even remotely excited, but I feel obligated to get it for nostalgia. Is the hype for Pokemon dead, and have you ever bought a game because you feel loyal to the series?
I am going to jump in, Lance, because recently in our little gaming pictures that we have to talk about what new ideas we're going to turn into lists and other videos, there was I brought up video game franchises that need to change, and it was based off of the new trailer for Pokemon. Is it Scarlet Violet? I don't know which one we're on now.
Maybe Sapphire?
No, we've done Sapphire. Surely we've done Scarlet. Whatever.
Probably.
It is.
Whatever the new one is.
It is so unmemorable, we can't remember the name. But every single person that was in the comments was saying, oh, good to see the GameCube is still kicking out their titles. Good to see this, like, gameplay has moved on since Let Me Check My Watch 2000. Like, it's really, really basic and generic, this new-looking game that's coming out. And I, for one, genuinely think that we are about to see potentially the death of the Pokemon video game. I think we're going to actually get critical, like, this thing.
I'm going to get it.
I know you're shaking your head on it, and I know that IGN out there is going to give it an 8 out of 10 no matter what, but I genuinely think that most of you people are going to go, actually, this has been the same thing for over a decade now.
The weird thing is, this is the year that they changed it. Pokemon Arceus is it's not a complete uprooting of everything, but they changed it for the first time since 1996.
But they're putting it into such a traditional formula. All they've done is add an open world-esque element or like 3D elements to it. There doesn't seem to be any sort of real progression to what Pokemon is at its core. And for some reason, for some people, that's absolutely fine. But for me, I want to see the innovation. I want to see them actually try and take it forward. Mm. And they've actually got competition now in the form of Palworld. They've got a Pokemon capturing game with guns.
Not the gun game.
That is advancing the formula. We're taking things further.
The innovation one the Pokemon clip at needs a time. Is not a machine gun. I don't think that's the way the Pokemon needs
okay,
to go.
But tell me that Pokemon is worse with a machine gun.
I mean, it worked for Shadow the Hedgehog.
Listen, so exactly.
Sometimes.
And do you know what? I'm not a Pokemonsman. but if the Pokemon wielded guns,
yes,
maybe I'm in, because Shadow the Hedgehog is the best Sonic-related thing that's ever happened, and maybe the most iconic character of all time. I don't know.
Jules wouldn't agree with you on that, and he's not as big of a Sonicsman as me.
But I'm just laughing. One of the most iconic characters of all time. That's pop
Shadow.
That's popped me big, that ass voice.
Yes. But yeah, in terms of Pokemon stuff, I don't think it's dead, but I think the biggest reaction is because they've done two games in the same year. I think a lot of people are annoyed about that. Yeah. It feels like what Ubisoft did with Assassin's Creed Unity and Rogue in the same year. And I feel like that's the general response is like, oh my God, you guys do this every year, which they have done for so long. But now it's twice in the same year and everyone's kind of gone, all right then, you calm down, guys. But I'd love Arceus. I've got like over 100 hours in it. I love that game. I think it's great. I hope that they build on those new mechanics and everything else. I think it'll take a lot more than this to kill Pokemon, because it's effing Pokemon.
But what killed Guitar Hero? It was oversaturation of its own market, and they didn't innovate enough. Mm. And that is what Pokemon is teetering towards, because like you say, releasing two games so close to each other, and the second game of the two seems so less innovative, so less interesting, so low effort compared to the previous one. People are just going, what's the point of this?
I think it's like a warning sign. I think that, it's that whole thing of really testing the fan base. And it's like a warning sign of like, you can't do this too many times in too quick a succession.
Yeah.
Like I said, Pokemon feels like, I mean, Pikachu is like the third most recognizable character in the world or something.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying it's the death of the Pokemon video game as a cultural milestone rather than it being probably the actual death of the franchise.
I would love them to take a minute and just take any dev time and make it so that the world doesn't look like it's a giant bin bag. That would be quite nice.
I mean, seriously, the visuals are so crispy that Josh Brown's trying to fish around in them for crumbs. He loves his crispy, doesn't he?
I'm going to tip them upside down and just guzzle all of the crumbs out of it.
Point being, that's not even point being, but we should talk about the second half of this question, which is the idea of buying into a game just because you feel loyal to the series. I'm all in on Sonic Frontiers because I love Sonic. That's maybe mine.
It was Mass Effect Andromeda for me. That was the game that, you know, I loved. I loved even Mass Effect 3. Like, that game obviously ended.
Even.
That game obviously had a disappointing ending that we won't go over now, but I still enjoyed the bulk of that experience. However, when Andromeda came around, everything was screaming, this is going to be disappointing. Yes. From the weird initial trailers, to the dev diaries, to the kind of just half-baked idea to be begin with, to even continue the franchise at all, and of course where EA and BioWare were at the time. However, I bought into that, and I honestly at the time thought it was the worst game ever made. I couldn't click with it at all, and it only got after about 10 hours of play, but before then, man, I was so disappointed.
Yeah. I remember like really liking the combat a lot, and then like the whole, I was like trying to get on board with new BioWare at the time, like, oh, big open space, look at all these missions I can do, like how open plan this is, and trying to like design a new world and everything, but it never came together. It was like at best like a 5 or a 6 out of 10 or something.
Like, the biggest disappointment with that game is the fact that you're going to a brand new galaxy. You have limitless possibilities for creativity and imagination, and what do you get? An ice planet. A planet that is warm.
Rocks. There's a few floating rocks at the beginning. Jules, you have been loyal to an IP?
Well, this is where my huge hypocrite alert comes out, because I've just said that people buy Pokemon over and over again and don't expect innovation. But what do I pick up every single time a new one comes out? Dynasty Warriors, baby!
Of course!
They have been getting progressively worse for the last two games. Dynasty Warriors 9 and Empires were absolute dog. So I am still going to buy the next one.
Because you gotta know.
Yeah, gotta know.
I used to like Dynasty Warriors back in the day, but I was never like a huge fan. What about it keeps you coming back?
I think it's the it sounds like I'm being detrimental to it, but it's the mindless repetition of I am overpowered and I'm killing everything with ease. That power fantasy is so easy to tap into. Plus, the characters are so over the top that you can't help but be amazed that the way they act as well is just like, I'm about to fall into a trap. Oh no, but I'm still going to go into the trap anyway. Oh, it's so silly. It's ridiculous, but it's... I think that Koei Tecmo are the only company that just go, it's the same game. We're not even trying to hide it. It's literally the Romance of the Three Kingdoms again.
You bought it last time, maybe you'll buy it again.
With three new characters, bringing the roster up to like 90 or something like that. And you're like, hope you're going to have fun maxing out all of them.
Oh, amazing.
I feel like mine's definitely Sonic. I'm not going to go on about it again because I feel like I do it every single podcast. But I'm at this stage, I'm just too curious. I'm too into the IP, and I need to know what that game is. Yep. So we'll see. Next question from Schmans Schmilliamson, who says, with Halloween soon, what is your best costume that you remember that you've ever been able to wear? Is the end of my made-up sentence for that. Okay. What's your best Halloween costume ever? As a kid, I was a zombie, which was very good. Also, I was Goku, and also my mum made me a homemade Shawn Michaels costume as a five-year-old. It was complete with a WWF belt, Shawn shirt, and pants. She put broken hearts on. It was the best.
Amazing.
That's really cute. That's really, really fun.
I always hate getting dressed up. Never a fan at all. I dressed up as Solid Snake when Metal Gear Solid 1 came out.
Yep.
My little cardboard gun.
It's so funny after we have done literally 8 hours of filming in costume today.
I've spent more time in costume today than ever. I hate getting dressed up. It's the worst.
Yeah, I love it. I love the fact you can just escape into just being something completely different for a bit. My best Halloween costume that I remember the most was the film The Warriors. I dressed up as a baseball Fury. So I had like the not clown makeup, but it was like sports face paint style thing. It was yellow and black, and I had the baseball bat and the baseball outfit on and a big wig and stuff. Such a good time, because you would walk down the high street and 90% of people would not know, would have a clue what it was. They'd be like, oh, a clown? Yeah, okay. Or a sports guy. But then there was like one person that was like, the Warriors! And then like clinking of the bottle noise. It's like, I'm out to play. And I was like, yeah!
That's cool.
For me, I used to have a standard one, and it was incredibly low effort, because all you need is a pair of black trousers, a bloodied white working shirt, a Shaun of the Dead badge. So I went Shaun of the Dead. Yeah. And when you're like a broke student, you could bust that out every single year. I think I might have even worn it 2 years in a row without washing it, and it stunk. It wasn't good. However, a few years ago, I did actually put a bit more effort into it and went as the Log Lady from Twin Peaks.
Oh, I remember doing that. Yeah, yeah.
Which I was really proud of. You know, I was looking forward to that. No one got it, even though I was carrying around a plushie of a log all night, which wasn't good when you got to the clubs, by the way. No. That thing got dirty. It was on the toilet floors. It wasn't great.
That's why I never like dressing up, because you always got to go to the club, and then it's just never maneuverable around the club.
Yeah.
Right. Sorry to make it all about me, but I've just got like so many awful club stories. One year, I decided to go as Patrick Bateman, but the issue with Patrick Bateman is he wears like four layers. So I had a full suit on with the raincoat over the top.
Oh, God.
In a club, in a sweaty club. I was not looking my best that night.
Those waterproofs, they keep water out and keep water in. Okay, those sweat. You were just having like a little humid tent over there. Horrible.
The bouncers wrung me out. They literally wrung me out. They had to squeeze all the water out of me.
I will shout out a general. Yeah, I remember doing, because I was trying to think of any times I've dressed up. Student times. Yeah, because you kind of have to. It's like everyone's going out for this thing.
Everyone does it.
So I was like, I knew that my now wife was going to be out on this one night. So I was like, look, I'll do the absolute bare minimum. So it was just buy a shirt from Primark and cut some holes in it.
No.
And then scatter the blood over it and just do an Alan Parker. I'm a zombie. Like, that was just all I could muster.
Still on a spike.
Why
that's,
now?
That's impressive, right? Because every year for about 10 years, I've always said, this is the year I'm going to do the Alan Partridge zombie. But if you go out as the Alan Partridge zombie, you are looking weird. You are scaring people off for all the wrong reasons.
The three people in this room would get that reference, and then that might be about it in the modern day. I don't even know if people know the Alan Partridge zombie.
But imagine the pop on the night out. Nobody gets it. And then you lock eyes with someone from across the dance floor.
And find another person dressed exactly the same. Do a duet. Next question from Adam Tuku says, big up the UB3. With all these remakes coming out, let's be real, for unnecessary games, which absolute classic would you love to see remade for the new consoles? Now, I know we've done this conversation quite a lot, but I just thought I would do a quick whip round. He's also saying that Dead Space is unnecessary.
That hurts me.
Unnecessary is a bit of a stretch. Mm. I mean, like, I get that they're just trying to hold on to the licensing rights, and because Callisto Protocol has come out, but there's nothing wrong with a Dead Space remake per se. I'm hoping that the microtransactions won't be a significant thing.
Dead Space is really old now. I say really old. It's like 15 years. 14, 15 years. Yeah. To me, that is really old.
It's a teenager.
Would you say that it's a 10-year mark you're allowed to remaster it?
Like
a decade. A decade is a long time.
I would say so, but then they remade The Last of Us after 9, which is just about on the cusp, and I would say that felt too soon. I reckon as soon as you start edging towards 15, that's when you get full leeway from myself, because that's potentially two full console generations rather than just one.
Yeah.
Mine's always just like, what does it feel like could actually be improved? Like in Dead Space, it's like, well, you can make the interiors a bit more dank and drippy, but I feel like Dead Space is pretty solid anyway, so like that'll be a nice thing to go back through. But I feel like I've mentioned Soul Reaver every time. I'm not going to talk about it too much, but Soul Reaver's mine because you can do so much more with those environments. And the script is already like God's tier.
Yeah.
So just like back that up. Have the visuals meet the same bar as the script. And the thematics and the world and everything else, and you've got a stellar game.
I think you would have to choose something from the PS1 or PS2 era to really like give it a remaster, because if you go further back than that, then it's, with the Schneiders, you have graphics that are brilliant for what they were. Like, it's a completely different medium going from 2D to 3D. Mm-hmm. So a remaster or remake, I might as well just go for the big one and say, I want a full proper HD for the Switch remake of Majora's Mask. Like, build it from the ground up again.
Oh, so they did that for the DS one.
They did,
but it's like stuck on 3DS.
Yeah, so like do it again, but for the Switch.
Yeah, I would take that for Ocarina as well. I was thinking maybe they would never do it. And again, they tried it on the 3DS, but like Mario 64, with a proper 360 camera, you'd make it so it's way more modern, like Mario Odyssey physics. Like, you could do something with that.
People really hated that one that came out for the DS because it had loads of extra characters and it changed the way that the game changed. And I was like, but that's so cool. That's a really cool idea.
I remember Benjamin Richardson just absolutely hating it. I think he was more like, the original is the best. Okay. How dare you touch this, Nintendo?
I want to see, and this is going to sound stupid because they have done it, but I want to see Resident Evil 2 remade, but not in the way that they did it. That is a great game, but I want them to do it in the style of the Resident Evil 1 remake, where you keep the gameplay almost identical, keep the isometric view, keep the classic layout, keep the classic mechanics, but just make it look like a modern game, because the GameCube version of Resident Evil Remake still looks incredible to this day.
Yeah,
insanely good. And it makes you wonder, are we going to approach that level of remakes and remasters? Because they go remakes and they do it in a cinematic style for the modern audience. But do you think that we're then going to go in even further than that? And like you say, they're going to go back to old titles and remake them in a classic fashion rather than a new interpretation.
I guess it depends what the market dictates. I feel like isometric horror hasn't been done in so long. That's why I love the medium so much. Yeah. But that's like one game in 10 years that sort of like had isometric camera angles. And even then, it wasn't all the time.
Yeah.
But I just, I miss isometric horror. I forget what this came up recently on a podcast. And I was like, I miss tank controls and isometric horror and really cool atmospheric camera angles and things that made you just like struggle to survive against something.
I'll tell you what as well. I know Silent Hill 2 is going to be getting
it'll be announced by the time this goes up.
Yeah, a remake. However, you know, we were talking off mic earlier on about like Silent Hill 1, and I love Silent Hill 1, but that thing is trapped to the PlayStation 1, and it is kind of rudimentary. It's very much a first go at this franchise. Mm-hmm. But it has so many cool ideas, has so many cool characters and locations that I would love to see again in the classic style, not transferred to the Resident Evil over-the-shoulder camera. Like a classic Silent Hill 1 remake done on modern machines.
I think, just to round this off, I think that era, anything that's sort of mid-90s, the discovery of 3D, and then that massive push to be like, what can we do now that we're in this other dimension? And Final Fantasy VII, Metal Gear Solid, Silent Hill, Resident Evil, whatever. Like, it's anything from that era I would take, but I also want just a way to play them. Like, I just want to be able to access Metal Gear Solid whenever I want, but, you know, with up-res graphics or whatever, but keep the soul of it intact.
You're right. You're making a good point. We need to remake Crash Bandicoot, The Wrath of Cortex right now. Because that is not easily accessible.
No. / deleted forever. Definitely from all the servers.
It's the real Crash 4.
I can't. Next question from D, who says, love the podcast. After demo discs have come up quite a few times lately, I'm wondering which game you only had on demo disc that you played over and over and over but never bought as a kid.
Oh, okay.
Mine was Metal Gear Solid because of the mature rating.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Mine was The Unholy War.
I was going to say Unholy War.
It was actually.
Oh my God, I love that game.
Shout out to Peter Austin for actually having a copy of that and actually letting us play it.
Blew my mind that it was real.
I swear it was a fever dream. It's weird, isn't it, that some games that were on the demo discs never actually came out to full releases? Because I remember there was a game in which you were defending the Earth from these alien invaders. It was kind of an RTS-style thing. But
I think you're thinking of Body Harvest.
I don't know what it was, man, but I remember it had a banging soundtrack. And it was like, the Earth is doomed.
I'm a big fan.
The Earth is doomed. Yeah, it's great.
I would shout out Speed Freaks. I never bought the full Speed Freaks.
I had Speed Freaks.
I was a Crash Team Racing guy, so I was just like, I don't need Speed Freaks, I'll go Crash Team Racing. But I had the demo for Speed Freaks. I'd also shout out Vib Ribbon. Never managed to secure a copy of that, but play the demo over and over, because I'm sure even in the demo you could put other songs on.
You could,
and play through that way. So I was just like, this is the game. Yeah, so I just kind of did that.
Nice.
Also shout out to Vib Ribbon. Remastered that. Put that out.
Yeah, because
tie it in with my Spotify.
Yeah, that would be amazing. If Spotify bought it as a game that was included in their player, they would have like a brilliant little thing there.
Easy.
It's pretty good. I don't know which installment it was, but it was one of these Zone of the Enders games. Probably two.
I never bought two.
Actually bought the thing outright, but I played that first level or whatever you get over and over and over again, and then decided I didn't like mechs, so then just didn't buy the game. But it was a cool demo, and I enjoyed it, and I know people love that.
I love the original. Yeah, I never played Second Runner, but I mean, Zone of the Enders sold because they put the Metal Gear 2 demo with it. But at the same time, I still really liked Zone of the Enders 1, as my throat failed me.
Do you remember when they put out the demo disc for Time Splitters 2, and it ended at a certain point in the level? It was like the dam level, the Siberia one. Mm-hmm. And I remember it ending there and being like, oh my God, this is the best. And I played it with my friend Liam over and over and over again as we waited for the actual release of Time Splitters 2 to come out. And when it came out, that level didn't end there. It actually went further on. You fought a helicopter on the dam. I was like, what is this?
That whole Time Splitters 2, that damn level, that was our GoldenEye. I know we had GoldenEye as well, but that's it.
We did only stealth runs. Like, could you make it through the entire level apart from the zombies kill every single person? And that was the best challenge.
I love that kind of like setting you up for one thing and then you getting another. Because obviously, another one that I obviously ended up buying was Metal Gear Solid 2.
Oh,
but
nice.
Just you got the full tanker chapter for that demo,
which is mad when you consider how you're playing as the only portion with Snake. That's the, you literally have the full experience. Like, what?
That's it, man. So when you actually get, I mean, I put like 10, 15 hours into that demo alone, just replaying the tanker, replaying
the
tanker.
Because you can get the machine gun, the FAMAS or whatever, you couldn't get it in the
so many like secrets it held, but obviously then you get the real game and then you finish the tanker chapter and then you're playing as Raiden and you're like, this is not what I've been playing for tens of hours already. This is not what I expected.
That switcheroo, like that sent ructions through our year group in school at the time. Like, who was okay with it, who was incredibly annoyed about it at the time, and I guess just in general I was totally fine with it, but I was just like, this is not what I bought whatsoever. But yeah, one of the greatest switcheroos in gaming history, I guess. Next question from PG Quips, who says, UBP. How much do you think playstyle plays a part during the review process? For instance, I played Deathloop completely different to my friend. He played the entire game stealthy, but I went in guns blazing. He found it slower and fell off the game, whereas I had a literal blast.
You know what? That is a perfect thing to point out, because a review usually only comes from one person and their experience varies drastically depending on how you play the game. Mm. If a game is completely open-ended, then... yeah, that is going to...
Something I think it depends on the game. If it's like Skyrim or something that's super open-ended, it's like, well, you played a mage or you played an archer or whatever. But I would always try and identify the amount of paths there are available to me. And if I'm reviewing it, I'm in a very specific review mindset. Yeah. So that would be my thing. I would try and identify the amount of options available to me and then progress it. So I would hate to have reviewed Skyrim. Well, that would have been a nightmare.
Imagine trying to play... what was the name of the Deus Ex game that Square Enix published? Was that Human Revolution, the first
Human Revolution was 2011, and Mankind Divided after
so
that.
So when that game came out, if you played that game as a stealth character, you had a bad time. You had a really bad time with that game. And so I can imagine that any reviewer that wanted to go through the sort of hacking and stealth thing probably was just like, this game sucks, it's really bad. But anyone else who went in action, guns blazing, a bit more use of the tech, probably had a much more fun time. So
it's a weird thing, just to quickly, like, before I hand it to you, JB, like, that whole thing of, like, in Deus Ex, I was mostly stealth and conversation-based and hacking and stuff, but I did have a few points in action. But even in those fighting those boss fights, I was like, this just feels broken, this feels wrong anyway. But I think it's just that, I guess it's like a feeling, or trying to see what other options are available to you before you, like, specifically write it down as like, this is a broken mechanic or this feels wrong or whatever.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the two examples that spring to mind for me that I think are interesting to pick apart is Ghost of Tsushima. You know, when we were playing through that game, Scott, you and I both loved it, but for different reasons. We approached the game completely differently, and the way that we progressed through that game was completely different, and we kind of hit different beats at different times. Like, I was focusing on the side missions, you were focusing more on the main missions, and yet we still came out loving the game, and yet, you know, I was kind of throwing all of my love into the side mission part of it. I know you played some. It's like,
I was going to say, I did loads of side stuff and like random NPC stuff.
Yes, just in kind of like different orders, I suppose. And I focused on that stuff, whereas you got to it more towards the end.
We had a weird thing where we sort of dovetailed off in different directions. You did like the signposted side missions with the specific side characters. I did the random like dynamic stuff where it was like someone's lost a dog or whatever it is.
Yes.
And I did them. And then like, that was mixed in in by doing every now and then I would do a main mission. Yeah. So in between those two, I missed the specific side things, which affects which allies come to you in specific parts of the story. And so, yeah, but some of that stuff didn't make sense, but the game does account for that regardless.
Oh, totally. Like, you still saw it. It was just interesting that we both came away, like, having the same overall kind of critical view of the game, but we were loving it for, like, different reasons. Mm. Like, I remember saying to you, like, Scott, I love these side missions so much. And I think there was one guy that you couldn't remember the name of, and I was like, that's fascinating that we got, like, we got to the same point, just in radically different ways. Mm-hmm. I think the other genre that kind of springs to mind as well that definitely caters towards different play styles is, like, a roguelike, because obviously that's mostly, like, procedurally generated, so you might not even get the same rooms. So how can you even, like, analyze the game in that way? Because everyone's playthrough is going to be completely different, and then it takes into account skill. Like, we talk about Hades a lot, and, you know, how much of the story that you see in that game from dying versus if you just kind of, like, blitz through it and then you kind of miss the story. Mm. Like, you're missing a layer, which is what I did.
Yeah.
So, like, I love that games are so... I have so many permutations now that, you know, I love reviews because they offer a specific perspective on it. And I don't think we could get, like, completely objective reviews because of that, because everyone will experience even the most linear game in a slightly different way. Even The Last of Us Part 2, you can play all of that by just ghosting through enemies and not even killing them, or you can fully engage in the combat.
I think that, the nearest thing to a more objective review is what Digital Foundry have started doing, where it's just a tech analysis. Like, as long as I know they do more than just a tech analysis, but they are so good at the tech stuff that they kind of get held up as, like, analyzing the frame rates, the resolutions, the detail, and everything else. I think that it's just, like, it's hard. It's sort of per genre, and it depends, like, how much of a game it feels like you're seeing to then pass judgment on or whatever. Just because, like you said, like, play styles can change. But I would, it would be too personal if I played an RPG in a certain way and then I criticized it for having played it that way. It's like, does the game feel unfair? Does it feel like I have options open to me? Like, something like Sekiro, it's just sort of like, well, is my method failing over and over again? Is this boss too hard, or do I have more options that I'm not doing? I remember when I played Doom Eternal, which I think I reviewed, that game was a blur, but I remember playing Doom Eternal and struggling on some of the bosses and some of the enemies, and then realizing that I wasn't using my the flamethrower thing as much as I should be, fast that recharged, and then that adding another, like, beat to the rhythm of that game, and then being able to stay in the pocket of getting right up in the face of everything, and then burning through levels way faster and being like, okay, this is the game, this is great. And the way that it made me question that, like, you know, almost just instinctively or whatever, is actually one of its greatest strengths.
Yes, so it's basically the game got good when it taught you how it wanted to be played.
Yeah. I always think anyone playing any game, I think sometimes it's good if you think that something is hard or whatever, just taking a step back and being like, am I using all the tools available to me? Like, maybe there's something that you're missing or whatever. Next question from Chris Shaw, who says, hello from Australia. Just curious if any of you have ever tried Vegemite. Also, it was really hard to type this while riding my kangaroo.
Amazing. Absolutely.
Standard.
Amazing.
Very good. Very
10
good.
Out of 10, no notes.
So the funny thing is if you guys actually tried Vegemite?
No.
I don't even know what that is.
People always think, oh, it's just Marmite. It's not. It's totally different. Okay. So it's Vegemite is weaker than Marmite, which is why the Australians slather it all over their stuff. And when they come over here, they put the same amount onto, like, toast or whatever they're having. And they're like, core blimey, this is a bit much, friend. And it's like, well, yeah, because this is the extract, the purest of the pure. It's the it's the dark stuff. Let's get it on.
Have you had a Vegemite sandwich?
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with MasterClass. With MasterClass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with MasterClass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
I have not had a Vegemite sandwich, but I have had Vegemite, and I could just be like, yeah, it's fine. It's Marmite light.
I've heard about Vegemite sandwiches.
Marmite. Yeah,
Marmite. On the radio. Next question. Well, I'm guessing, Josh, you've never heard of Vegemite?
I haven't even tried Marmite, so I don't
really?
Know. Nah, I've heard it's like Marmite.
My
so
stupid
I don't really
brain
try it.
Literally did that.
Nah, I'm okay. A bit scared.
My brain literally almost said that too. It's almost like it's very Marmite, that. And I was like, no, brain, you're thinking too fast.
Isn't that amazing how a company has managed to turn what is actually a negative in the sense that people genuinely hate it into a saying about the product, meaning that it's created its own marketing brand in your head.
That's it. Crazy. Rent-free in your brain now.
It's a very effective. Next question from Krell Type Shaw, who says, hey guys, I've got two questions this time. Do you think the MCU has been a bad influence on movies and games, i.e. forcing connected universes, writing dialogue, etc.? And number two, feudal Japan is having a resurgence as of late. What are the settings slash eras do you think need to make a comeback? MCU stuff, me and Josh talked about this the other day. Okay. I feel like when we play... You watch a movie, you do whatever, there's this kind of assumption of a post-credit scene. There's an assumption of a tie-in to something else. There's an assumption of sequelization or spin-offs or whatever. It's very rare that something feels like a one-off. And I think on the business side, there's always that idea that it can become something bigger and that they're planting seeds for something they might want to pull out later. I feel like the MCU very much taught various studios of what shared universes can be. And I feel like a lot of them chase that now.
Yeah, I agree, and I hate to say it because I still really like the MCU, but it reminds me of something like the modern military boom in gaming. Like it's like Call of Duty itself was a good franchise, making good games at the time, and it's not its fault that it got so popular. It's the fault of everyone else trying to copy it and diluting the market and kind of ruining the market for many years in terms of creativity and the type of genres that you would expect.
Yeah.
In the same way that I don't think it's the MCU's fault for existing, because they're still doing interesting things. They're still making quite decent products. But I do think it's the impact that that's had on the box office and the culture that everyone's trying to mimic that. And again, it's homogenized the culture and it's flattened it out.
Much like in the same way that everyone jumped on the Battle Royale trend and killed it basically by everyone having it, and it became a game. If a game didn't have a battle royale mode, you either thought it was weird, and when it did, you saw that it was chasing trends. The thing with the MCU is, I would argue that they are writing themselves into a corner more and more, because every film is starting to feel like each other, because it's like, well, we've got to have quips, we've got to have like the funny moments, because people are sick of the gritty action hero now, and now we've got to give them the comedy action hero. But the problem is that when every film feels like the same, Scott and I were talking about how Phase 4 came and went, and I can't even tell you a single thing that happened into it, because I was so burnt out on the one interesting story that they were building.
I didn't even realize Phase 4 had started, but then they said it was ending.
It was ending. So now we're into this situation where, because every other film is feeling like an MCU product, and because the MCU itself is drilling down into this one specific manner of what an MCU film is, we are actually approaching a sort of a meeting point of all films where people are just going to get sick of them. Surely, there's like a little curve thing that's used in film.
A bell curve?
It might be the bell curve, but it's like it goes into like resurgence, pastiche, and something else.
I think that's
like,
a bell curve.
Yeah, and it's basically like it's super, super popular. Everyone really likes it. Jumps in the bandwagon, and now we're completely
we
are bored of it.
So yeah, it's like the different phases that various different genres have gone into over the years. Westerns very much did that. Yeah. It's like you enter the part of parody, and then it's like, where do you go from there? Well, you need to take a rest, and they won't take a rest.
Tell us a new story.
Yeah,
effectively.
I'll tell you what makes that even more frustrating as well. The fact that it's kind of homogenizing the style and the tone and the presentation of all those movies is that the expected thing for new and interesting directors now is to be promoted to a Marvel movie eventually. Yeah. And the Marvel machine, the MCU machine, has gobbled up so many interesting directors, and they may still be producing good work, but you can tell they feel constrained, in my opinion. Yeah. You know, the likes of Ryan Coogler. You know, Black Panther is really good, but I want to see what else Ryan Coogler has to offer, because, you know, Fruitvale Station, I loved Creed. I thought it was incredible. Mm. Like, he had a great trajectory, and I'm sure he's enjoying himself, and, like, you know, I'm not saying he's trapped or anything, but I want to see what original things he has to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm. Taika Waititi is also a good example because of the fact that his independent films are incredible stories, very personal, and elements of comedy within them that is uniquely his own. But as soon as he gets put in front of a big budget like the Marvel one, we get Thor Love and Thunder, which just, wow. It was basically like he looked around and just said, right, okay, jokes, let's just have every joke all the time. Let's not even worry about continuity. Let's just have jokes, guys.
I think as well, just to throw another thing in, is that like the MCU stuff makes me think of that everything has lore, everything has a world to it. So if I'm going to play something, I'll almost look into the wider lore. So I'm just like, where does this game sit in the overall timeline? How many supplementary materials are with this? Does it have books with it or whatever else? Like, I mean, I was never jumping into a sequel for something anyway, unless like for whatever reason, that's the recommended one. But overall, like, I feel like, I don't know, I just feel this assumption that everything has a wider feel to it.
Yeah.
And I end up like looking into a bunch of stuff that I clearly don't need to.
Do you get annoyed when game companies come out much later and say, actually, these worlds were connected? Like, they recently had that one with Arkane Studios coming out and saying Dishonored was linked to another franchise.
Yes, it was Deathloop, I think.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, did it need to be? Did it actually need to be involved in that?
That's the thing. I think having grown up, like all of us, like through the MCU stuff, I'm like, oh my God, these movies are connected. Oh my God, they're doing this. Now it's just this random thing you can just say. And it's not like, it doesn't do anything for me personally anymore, saying these games are connected. I thought it was cool that Remedy did their Remedyverse stuff, like where it was Alan Wake and Control. Yeah. And I was like, sure, why not? But I'm just like, why not? It doesn't do anything. It doesn't make it cooler or better.
Yeah, you don't immediately go, well, I'm going to go buy Alan Wake now because it's connected to this. You just go, oh, cool, that is a game.
Like, unless they specifically, you know, like you're playing one character and then you don't realize that alongside that something else was happening or a mystery gets fleshed out in a different game or something. Things where they fundamentally connect to each other. I don't care about shared universe stuff.
Yeah,
anymore.
It's not necessarily for me anymore because it makes it feel like a chore. Like, the MCU now, I do think, is in a bit of a decline, and it's because there's so much content to get through. Mm-hmm. Like, before, there were 3 movies a year, and that's already a lot, and now you've got 3 or 4 movies a year, and you've got 3 or 4 TV shows to keep up with, and you don't need to watch everything, but the sheer volume of it makes it feel more disposable, whether it is or it isn't. It's like if you got, it's like when you got an Assassin's Creed game every year,
right?
You know, like that needed to stop because it's not like the games were, you know, horrible. It's just that people got tired. People felt like they were disposable because they were being treated as if they were disposable.
The thing that killed them as well is that there was no, like, you can argue there was an overarching story, like barely some of the present day stuff, but it wasn't anything close to the Ezio trilogy or whatever. Like, it wasn't like, oh my God, I need to see what happens next. It was just, here's more stuff. Do you want some stuff?
Yeah.
And I feel
like
MCU is kind of there now. It's like, here's some more stuff. Do you want some bit more? Yeah. Like, nothing that really sort of makes you go, I'm going to watch the next one for an answer or something. In terms of settings, the other half of Type Shaw's question was, whether we think that, you know, Feudal Japan's very much coming back at the minute. Obviously, I think very much inspired by Ghost of Tsushima. I forget which interview said that.
Okay.
That because Ghost of Tsushima did so well in, you know, around the world, that it's showed that you can do old school Japan stuff, Feudal Japan stuff, in a more traditional way, and it will be embraced by the West. And obviously, the Yakuza games made their way across over the last 10 years. The franchise is older, but they very much came to the West across the 2010s. Other settings that we want to see make a comeback. It's a weird one, I'm going to say, but Cyberpunk stuff. I feel like there's a whole thing with the cyberpunk genre where it feels like Cyberpunk 2077 should have sort of kicked off this whole run of cyberpunk stuff. And you get things like Ghost Runner, you know, you get things like Neo Cab or whatever. There are like a handful of additional games, but no one, it doesn't feel like a staple of gaming. Like, it doesn't feel like overall we get like a, it's like Cyberpunk is like one of the only ones with that kind of budget. And I feel like there's a whole wing of cyberpunk source material or stories to be told. world or explorations of transhumanism or whatever that you could just do way more with. And I would, I want Cyberpunk to be more than just the Cyberpunk game.
It's like when Deus Ex, obviously Square Enix brought out those two games, it was a case of, okay, is this going to kickstart more people talking about this? But it didn't.
No.
It was maybe because those games itself were, in Square Enix's own words, disappointments when it came to
plus,
sales.
Like, Deus Ex was like, had, I guess, Cyberpunk elements, but there wasn't that much of sort of Jensen questioning him himself. They tried to do bits of that in Mankind Divided.
It was
tried
very
to,
forced in
there. Yeah, they tried to do all the like the apartheid metaphors, and it was like what are you guys doing?
It's like, am I really human if I replace all my body parts and machines? It's like, I don't know,
What an interesting question.
Yeah. It's yes. Like, it hasn't been asked a million times before.
Ship of Theseus. I feel like there's there's ways to do it. I think Cyberpunk should be more than a game. Right now, when people say Cyberpunk, they think of one game, and it should be a whole, or in theory, it should be a whole genre.
I want to see more games that use the setting of like Big Brother, like 1984. I want to have that sort of the rise of the worker sort of thing. I do you know what? I had a daydream the other day. You've seen the film High Rise, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
You've seen that film.
Yeah. Ben Wheatley.
If that was a game. Seriously, like you start on the ground floor, much like The Raid, like working your way to the top, and you're battling rich people to like work your way up the level. I'd love that.
Just super quick. That's why everyone latched onto We Happy Few, but I know it didn't land anything.
That's a real shame. That
I was going to say, I always think the same thing with Snowpiercer, because that's kind of a similar gimmick where you've got this big train and you're literally moving through the classes as you go from carriage to carriage. Yeah. You start in the slums and you end up in like the most opulent carriages ever, where like the 1% literally live. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot, because mine's actually quite similar to that. It's just a few years in the future, after playing Scorn, and it reminding me of PS1 90s horror, like Abe's Odyssey, for instance.
Like just creepy stuff. Just
industrial
creepy
horror.
90s, specifically.
Give me the creep.
Industrial horror. You know, it's brown, it's dark, and it's like full of metallic body parts.
It's
dripping. It's dripping. It's gross. It's gnarly. Yeah. That kind of thing that I'm missing. I want more Abe's Odyssey. I want more Bruce Willis's Apocalypse from the PlayStation 1. You know, that kind of awful dystopian future that's very specific to the late 90s and early
2000s. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The 90s, like you said, on PlayStation had a very specific, like Abe's Odyssey should have inspired way more stuff. Like I think that is almost destined to be this sort of cult classic, even though it's big enough that we think of it as this big, popular, huge thing. But yeah, going through Scorn was such a reminder of old school PS1 horror, and exploring like a 3D space. I always I miss games that make the most of 3D spaces and verticality. And not that you can climb in Scorn, but that idea of like this massive place that you're going to just explore as you go forward. It feels like Tomb Raider did that so well, and then even that kind of got away from it over the years. Next question from Jack Jingle, best name ever, who says, "What's the best game you received as a gift for Christmas/birthday, etc.? Christmas when I got Pokemon and a Game Boy Color, take some beating." Now, my one for these is always the PlayStation 2. It was just getting a PS2. I used to get one at launch, and I just lived in my bedroom. But that Christmas, or the Christmas after it, I think it was Christmas after it, I got Devil May Cry 1 and Jack and Daxter. And I remember coming down, getting given these games, hugging my grandparents, and going back upstairs again.
Yeah, and that was it. And then I never saw you again.
I think I returned for the food, and then I went back upstairs again. It was a nice time.
I mean, it's I've told the story before where I bought myself the Jack and Daxter because I knew I was getting a PS2. So it was like a gift from me to me.
Oh, nice.
But then I was like, I think there's other ones. You know what? The most recent birthday that I had, my sister got me Mario Kart 8 Deluxe for the Switch, and I've got that. I've got Mario Kart 8 on the Wii U, but the deluxe version with all of the DLC now, I'm just like, genuinely, that's the best kart racing game, and it's got all of these brand new courses, so thank you very much.
Yeah,
brilliant.
That's a great gift. You'll never stop playing that.
Exactly.
Now.
I've not even remotely got tired. Like, I mean, I love Mario Kart, but like Mario Kart 8, that deluxe, there's a reason they just doubled down on the DLC. Like, it's perfect.
Yeah.
I had to
give my copy to Michael Hamflett.
Oh, my
God. He was in need. His copy broken, and I thought, you know what? I only play this twice a year when I go home. You can have it.
Oh, so good.
For me, it's Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare, because I was obsessed with this game before it came out. I was playing it around friends' houses. I'd already completed the campaign. I'd already put like hours and hours and hours into the multiplayer, and yet it didn't stop me from wanting to own it myself. So I got it for Christmas one year. I woke up extra early, and I'd also asked for a gaming chair that year as well. So I went downstairs, opened up Call of Duty 4,
unwrap my game and share, which would have been piss hard to wrap, by the way. Those yeah, things massive. Are like, they've got a strange
Is
curve
it, like
on them.
Weird sort of like banana-shaped one.
The banana-shaped oh, nice. One,
100%. So it didn't have wheels, it was just on the floor. You yeah. sit on the floor and you rock back you and mean. Forth.
It's like a pod, like you've yeah, been born
yeah.
in it.
Yeah. yeah, not like the modern game and no. chairs at like 300 pounds. This thing was like a banana.
Just a giant cradle.
It. Yep, no. it had speakers. Oh, it had speakers in the left and right of it, right Whoa. Near your legs. So I plugged it in. Put Call of Duty 4 on and like played half the campaign before my parents even woke up.
It's like my ears can hear the bullets. I love it.
I remember playing that Christmas in front of my grandparents and just and my dad going, "Can you put something else on?" So it was like gunned down half the populace watching playing that thing.
I think I've told this story before, but I remember getting Fallout 3 for one Christmas nice. And my granddad came over while I was playing it.
Nice.
And I remember we were just sort of like sat in silence because you know everyone's full from dinner or whatever. And I went into VATS while a dog was attacking me.
Oh,
I,
God.
I had a sawn off shotgun and blasted this dog's face into like smithereens.
His eye flying around. Like,
and I, like I'll always remember my granddad's chuckle of when that shot went off. I had no idea what to expect.
Grandma cried in the corner trying to get on with the rest of her bread and butter pudding.
Ruined the pudding, yeah, completely.
Next question, a bit of a more serious one from Willie Araya, who says, what are your final thoughts on the Bayonetta 3 controversy? I'm sad at what happened to Helena Taylor and voice actors in general. I'm also sad about what's happened to Jennifer Hale, and I'm more sad about what this has done to the games community. Hopefully the game can at least fully deliver. I don't know if you guys have been keeping up with all this stuff.
So what I know is that she was offered $4,000 to do the entire game voice of Bayonetta for Bayonetta 3. Mm-hmm. She turned it down, obviously, because that is an excessive amount of work.
There's an update since then, but yeah.
$4,000. Mm-hmm. Then instead of actually meeting her halfway, they got a new voice actress in, a veteran of the industry, mm-hmm. to go and do it. And a lot of hate was sent
to Jennifer Hale. Yeah, yeah.
Jennifer Hale.
Have you kept up with everything so far?
Yeah, I just got the update this morning from Bloomberg that yeah. said apparently she was offered £4,000 a session and it would have been like £15,000 overall minimum, which still sucks. Like, yep. that's a clarification yeah. that's worth mentioning, but $15,000 dollars for that kind of character is still a pittance, in my opinion, yeah, when you're yeah. insulting.
The amount of units they sell and how much the game retails.
Apparently that would have been the minimum. Apparently it was $4,000 per session, and it was like a minimum amount of sessions, but yeah, it was like the estimate was about $15,000. Yeah, that's been mentioned by Bloomberg Station, Shreya, corroborated by VGC. Helena Taylor's denied that and just said it was a lie, but whatever. I think overall, there's just that whole kind of question of where does the value come for the character? Is it in the voice actor? Is it in the coding department, the art department, whatever? I firmly believe that it's the voice actor just as much as anyone else.
Would you play and enjoy God of War Ragnarok if you didn't have the voice actor for Kratos?
I'd still play and enjoy it. I think that's weird. The thing, though. I think it's interesting. Yeah, I think that, like, but I think overall there is this devalue around voice actors in anime, in animation, in video games compared to quote unquote real actors, bringing in Chris Pratt to be Mario instead of Charles Martinet, whatever. And I do want voice actors in animation, in video games, and whatever to get their due, to get their yeah. day in the sun. Like, yeah, it feels like they're so overlooked.
It's like, I love me some Kojima, but I'm still not happy with the guy for replacing David Hayter with yeah. Kiefer Sutherland.
Not even telling him
in Metal Gear Solid 5. Like, that guy has made an iconic character through his vocal performance for decades at that point. And then, yeah, like you said, he was discarded and wasn't even told about initially. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that sucks, man, because I do agree what you said there. You know, there is a preference for so-called proper actors when, you know, you get those proper actors in, again, using air quotes there, and so often they crap the bed with it. Like, you look at, I love
Peter Dinklage.
New Vegas, I love Destiny. That's a bit generous. But Peter Dinklage came in, a great actor, crap the bed.
Yep.
Matthew Perry came in for Fallout New Vegas, was fell a asleep. Fan of the franchise, fell asleep, was not very good. You know, so many times we've seen great voice actors, great voice artists discarded for celebrities, and it sucks. And in this case, you know, it's even worse because they've been replaced with another gaming voice actor, and then they've received, Jennifer Hale's received, like, a lot of hate for that, and it's unjust because it's not her fault. It's the people in charge of casting, it's the developers, it's the people who are actually, you know, calling the shots at these studios.
Yeah, my thoughts overall are that, I mean, obviously it's still unfolding. Like, there was the update from Bloomberg and VGC. It just feels like there's, because there was the whole thing, Jennifer Hale said that she can't say anything. She was like, I'm under NDA, I can't talk about it properly. I just hope that overall the thing that comes out of of it is better conversations or better value put on the voice actors themselves. Like, I love animation, love video games, love voice acting as a talent. John DiMaggio's documentary on it is incredibly illuminating and just really fun. I'm sure it's called Whose Voice Is That? And it's just him just going to like all your childhood favorite voice actors and talking to them and just seeing how many people they've brought to life. Like, it's such a valuable part of entertainment, and it's so overlooked.
John DiMaggio is a great example because obviously when they came to redoing Futurama for Hulu, he was like, I'm not coming back because you're not meeting my monetary demands. But loads of people were immediately like, oh, you're greedy. You must be greedy if you're not getting back. It's like, not the case at all. He was fighting for a fair wage and representation for voice actors, which is sorely needed. He took a stand because he had the leverage to do so. And we need more people like that in the voice acting community to actually just say, no, I'm not going to do this until my I set a precedent that other people can quote and then also leverage it, because it's like unionizing, but without that word or that tone. Just make sure that the company respects those voice actors.
There's been tons of voice actors voicing their support as well, for the just in terms of getting more value, getting more respect, getting more exposure to the realities of different pricing amounts and everything because of this whole situation. So hopefully there's a net positive eventually. There was that whole SAG-AFTRA thing a couple of years ago about renegotiating general terms and everything, because sometimes voice actors will be asked to do, you know, various shouts and screams and right alongside a much softer scene. And then say, okay, now we're doing the next scene, go straight into it. There's no time to have a drink of water or take a minute or whatever it is, and just, you know, just get through the scenes, just get it done. And it's not an easy job.
It's not, and you know, like, it's not even like necessarily a flattering or a pleasant job in a lot of ways. Like, I don't claim to know any inside information about how voice acting is done right now, but you know, historically we've had stories of, you know, Mark Hamill and Kevin Conroy doing the first Arkham game, and them and the directors not even having the two in the same room, and apparently they found that really kind of like dejecting because it affected their performance, because they're doing it to a casting director who can still elicit good performances, but they were wanting that back and forth. They were wanting to be able to play a scene against the actual actors and then gauge their performance and react properly. And it's like, sometimes these guys are just in a booth doing the line straight through, and some people might love that, but it's kind of, you know, it's minimizing the creativity of it, I think, in a lot of ways.
I just love the, like I said, I love the craft of it. I love the ability to contort your vocal cords and bring something to life and be a completely different being or whatever. I just feel like it doesn't get its due. I feel like it's so constantly overlooked under the guise of, well, we'll get a movie person in, they'll be better. But they're not.
Yeah, I'll tell you what sucks as well, man. Like, obviously, it's not directly connected, but it is, like, all of this happening at the same time as we're getting a push towards AI-generated dialogue in games.
Darth Vader
is
now entirely AI.
Darth Vader, the Watch Dogs Legion protagonist, of course, you know, being entirely AI-generated. Of course, they still got actors in to perform those lines, but the lines in the way they were constructed in the game was done through an algorithm. Yeah. It's like, that's a dangerous precedent to set, to set, because you can tell right now, and maybe the stuff will become more sophisticated, the tech will become more sophisticated, but you don't want to be able to minimize a human job in that way, because that's where the emotion comes from.
Mm-hmm. There's the famous case of Jet Li turned down working on The Matrix because of the fact that he said, you're going to motion cap all of my fights and choreography, and they will be stored on a database, and you will be able to use that to recreate any movie in the future using that library of work. That is me and what I've trained for, and you are basically commodifying it and turning it into something that can be hired by anyone to put into their film.
That's like,
and
that wider...
It's like asset flipping almost. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's like software,
that,
don't you?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's like that whole wider hologram gig thing. It's like, well, we're like any sort of record company would love to put on 10 gigs at once around the world at the same time and do another 10 the night after, another 10 whatever the night
it's
after.
It's weird because you've got to think about the amount of voiceover lists that we've done, and I'm pretty sure that you could actually make a brand new list just cut together from entries from us. So that means that it's like almost deep faking us. I might be dead right now, and like, people are just using clips from the previous.
We're gonna have to cut this out. Don't give our bosses any ideas.
Season 3 of The Capture is that making list content. And we'll end on a nice lovely question from Gaming with Greg, who says, hey gents, question coming from Budapest, where is your favorite favorite city to travel to? Mine is Prague in the Czech Republic.
Oh, wow. Great question.
Prague is a big show.
Yeah, Prague is lovely. I've been there for a stag do, and it was just... the groom got hit by a train.
He's still okay?
He's fine.
Good.
But what happened was he looked the wrong way on the tram line, stepped on, and it hit him. Luckily, it was slowing down at the time, and it bumped him off the way. But the one thing that broke his fall was a carrier bag full of booze and glass. So he landed on glass bottles to break his fall.
It's a sign.
And the thing is, he stood back up again, and he was just like looking around like a bit stunned. And he was like, all my body parts completely intact. And I just fell onto this. His coat was shredded by the glass, but he was completely intact. I was like, you are so lucky. You're so lucky.
Jules, Josh, any picks?
It's boring because it's going to be in the UK. I love Glasgow, man. I've been there about 10 times this year.
Your bands keep going there.
I'm going there this weekend again. I feel like I'm well versed in that city, but I love it. I love going there. The people are so nice. Mm-hmm. There's so many underrated spots there. Obviously not if you live there, because you know I'm a idiot Englishman going to Scotland being like, look at these underrated spots. Andy Murray will be having a nightmare. But yeah, I love Glasgow. I think it's incredible. It's got a great music scene, and like the food places are amazing. And I love how. Not small and compact it is, but I don't like a big sprawling city. Like, I like Manchester a lot, but it's almost too big. Mm-hmm. I quite like London, but it's too big for me.
Newcastle's a good shout.
It's why I live in Newcastle, because everything is nice and compact and you can walk everywhere. So, Glasgow for me.
Big fan. I'm going to go with New York City.
It's opposite, basically, isn't it?
Just couldn't get enough of it. I've always wanted to go to America for so long. Me and my wife went there for our honeymoon, and it was just incredible. It was everything I always wanted it to be. I loved all the skyscrapers. The sheer size of that city, just being a speck in that city, was incredible. And I was actually, you just mentioned like a place that where you can get around quite easily. New York City, like, you could easily get, we easily got from Statue of Liberty all the way back up to, like, in the north again. Do you know what the name of the area was? The north of New York City. Very, very easily.
So, hello, mate. Like,
can I go to north?
To north of New York.
Then I went to west and to east. You could get around that city so well. So many incredible spots. Shout out to Sticky's Fried Chicken. Absolutely the best chicken in the world, or the world as far as I've experienced it.
Can't be better than Greg's.
It's very close. It's very close. Shout out to Greg's new sticky, their fried chicken, and also their wedges. Very, very good. But yeah, New York City, massive fan. Also went to New Orleans. But yeah, I would just shout out New York City. It was like being in a dream.
I'll tell you what, me and you have been to Amsterdam, not together this year.
Sadly not.
If I'd been there more, that might be my shout, because I love
Amsterdam
that.
Amsterdam is amazing.
I'd go there every weekend if I could. If I could afford it.
I was going to say, Amsterdam's whole, like this, it was such a healthy place. I felt massive. I felt like I was like ridiculously a massive, massive man, because everybody there was so in shape. Everyone's on bicycles. Everyone's either in little boats and stuff. But I just love that you could just sort of, I just went on my phone. I was like, can I rent a boat? And they're just like, yes, here, take this boat. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you're just on the sea. You're on the river.
Speaking of not looking the right way when transport is coming at you, though, it took a long time to actually adjust to Amsterdam's like cycle culture.
Yeah.
Because those guys don't stop. They will just, if you're in their way, you're getting cut down. You know what I mean? And that's not what it's like in the UK, which has eliminated all cycling.
No, there was a weird vibe of like, it's like a different sense they must have. Because we wanted to rent bikes, but I was like, I feel like I'm going to get taken out. Like if I get to one of the corners, but I guess you live there long enough, you just get it down. But shout out to cities all around the world. All good times. But yes, for now, this has been the Untitled Bandit Podcast. The UB3, the UB3.
UB3.
The UB3. A massive thank you to Jules Gill and Josh Brown for joining me. And a massive thank you to all of you for sending in all your questions. Next week, it'll be back to normal, I think.
It will be.
We'll see whatever happens. Maybe we need to don armor and do more stuff.
Maybe.
Another tease for what's coming. Keep an eye on Twitter. I'm at /LP89. Jules, you are.
I'm at RetroJ, but the O is a zero. And Josh is?
I'm at Josh Brown, but there's two O's, so it sounds like Brune.
Brune ale and lovely, beautiful stuff. We'll catch you next week.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
Thank you for having me, fellas. It's been a pleasure.
Anytime.
Oh, yeah, buy the mugs. Buy the mugs.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.